Now, hopefully, you're revived and ready to listen to the next session. It is a great pleasure to introduce two friends of whom I have the very highest regard, both as personalities but also as academics. I'm sure many of you know both of them. But just to remind you, our main speaker this afternoon is Dimitris Papadimitriou, who is Professor of Politics at the University of Manchester. He used to be a colleague here in the Hellenic Observatory. We have collaborated on many occasions, and Dimitris would be well known to you, talking about the Greek crisis, often on the BBC, and in his different writings. He has been a visitor at Princeton University and at Yale University, and as I say, he's written very extensively on politics and political economy. Our discussant this afternoon, Yorgos Pavlatos, will, I'm sure, be also very well known to you. George is a professor at the Athens University of Economics and Business, focusing on political economy. He's vice president of LEMF, the foreign policy think tank, the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy in Athens. George was also senior advisor and director of strategy at the Prime Minister's office in Greece in 2011-2012. He's a regular contributor to Kakimerini, and again, he has published widely. He's a regular contributor to Kakimerini, regular speaker in Greece, and in the media in Greece as well. So we have two great speakers this afternoon. And the focus that Dimitris is going to start with is five things we don't know about the economic crisis in Greece. Because of time constraints, he was going to offer six things that we didn't know about the crisis in Greece, but he said, please, we'll settle for five. So what we want to do is a short presentation. We've invited Dimitris to speak perhaps for 35, 40 minutes. We look forward to the response of George, perhaps for 15 minutes or whatever. All of that should mean that there will be plenty of time for your comments, your responses, and your questions. So we're looking forward to your active participation later. So, without further ado, please welcome our speakers this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Kevin. That's great. I'm very honored to be here. I'm a little bit nervous because I know many people here, and I have a long association with the observatory. I was here on the first PhD symposium.
Yes.
Which was many years ago. It reminds me how old I am. My only consolation is that I'm not as old as Kevin. So that's good. I take some comfort from that. But I don't take that much comfort from the fact that George is discussing my talk, because in many ways George knows a lot more about me than me about the Greek crisis. So I'll try and do my best. I'll try and fill the gap in between, as it were. And I'll try and keep things short. And hopefully that will allow us enough time to discuss at the end. As Kevin mentioned, the topic today is five things we don't know about the Greek crisis. When I proposed the topic, the title, I wasn't entirely sure which five things I would talk about. I'm not entirely sure today, but I'll try and do my best. Perhaps the first thing to mention, and that would apply, I guess, to many people here who are interested, of course, in Greece and also on the Greek crisis, is that the Greek crisis, empirically, it's a fantastic thing, right? There is a lot about the Greek crisis. I have, for my own research, I've tried to trace how many Reuters articles contain the word Greece and crisis. between 2008, the collapse of the Lehman Brothers, and the end of the third bailout. And the number is nearly 20,000. 20,000 Reuters articles talking about Greece and the Greek crisis. There are over 1,000 Google Scholar entries where the terms Greece and crisis appear in the abstract. A lot of scholarly work there. There are 122 articles that have been published in internationally recognized journals that contain the word Greece and crisis in the title. That compares incredibly to my mind with other sort of bailout countries. Greece has been over researched. Nearly 10 times more articles have been written on Greece than on Cyprus. 4 times as many articles published on Greece than on Italy. And nearly twice as many as there have been on Spain. So again, empirically and in terms of scholarly attention, Greece has been the Greek crisis has been a very well researched topic. I was also amazed to find out, as I was doing some research for today's talk, that there have been over, I have identified 45, but I'm sure there are more, books written in English that contain the word Greek and a crisis in the title. 45 books that have Greece and crisis on the title. There are many, many more books, of course, about the Eurozone crisis more generally. But just to give you some idea about the kind of well-populated field that we're talking about here. There are also, and that's the great thing about the Greek crisis, there are first-hand accounts about what has happened over the past 10 years. 2 finance ministers in Greece have written memoirs with very detailed accounts of what has happened. That's not something that happens often in Greece, if you look at it in terms of the broader history. Greek politicians do not write books in general, and that's very frustrating for some of us who wish
that. And many do not read them.
And many do not read them, absolutely. But in this case,
or they don't write them themselves.
Or they don't write them themselves. Perhaps they don't get big enough contracts, who knows. But in the case of the Greek crisis, there is an exception in that we have first-hand accounts from key protagonists of the crisis, but also by others outside Greece that have written about what has happened. So there is a lot of material for us to look at, as indeed is relatively exceptional the fact that some of the main international institutions that got involved in the 3 Greek bailouts have produced a lot of paperwork themselves. I mean, we know that the IMF has produced very candid accounts of what happened in the bailouts and what went wrong. The European Commission's website has a lot of information about the different missions and the various assessments of the program. The European Court of Auditors have published a huge report about the bailout. So the good thing about the Greek crisis is that we know a lot. There is a lot of material about it. But this is the good news. There are also bad news as well, in the sense that the Greek crisis is a scholarly subject that can be sort of dissected, can be approached from many different disciplinary perspectives. You know, even from the more popular discourse in Greece about the crisis, people say, you know, the crisis is not about economics, it's about politics, it's about the Greek political system. Others would say, oh no, it's about culture, it's about history, and so on. There are many different ways in which to approach what has happened in Greece and how we enter into this problem and how we are kind of exiting, if we are, from this. And from an academic point of view, I guess, that also creates complexities and problems in trying to disentangle in all of these. What is structure? What is part of the structural landscape of the Greek political economy, and what is attributed or can be attributed to agency. As a PhD, for example, can a successful PhD only look at agency without the structure? Can it only look at the structure without the agency? I will come back to this later on in my presentation, but for now, let's keep that in mind, right? That it is a scholarly topic that you can approach it from many different ways, and because of it, is not so straightforward to come up with sort of decisions about research design, about research questions, about data collection techniques, and so on, and so forth. The second problem of the Greek crisis as an academic, as a topic of a scholarly interest, is that it's very long. Its duration, 10 years. Well, we know that a week can be a very long time in politics, right? 10 years is a lifetime. And again, during that time, one often wonders if the crisis as a whole can be told as a single story, with a beginning in 2009-10 and end in 2018, or is it something that is perhaps lends itself more to a more fragmented type of interpretation, right? Are we talking about a single story or episodes during these periods that have their own logic, their own dynamic, and so on? And of course, in a policy problem, because the Greek crisis was an economic crisis, but it was also a major policy problem, both for the Greek government and its international creditors. During that 10 years, a lot has been learned, a lot of adjustment has been made, and in all of that, and all of that needs to be factored in how we approach the study of the Greek crisis and what kind of conclusions we can draw from it. You don't need me to tell you that, of course, the Greek crisis is not normatively neutral. It's a normatively very loaded topic. I will perhaps repeat here, it's a bit of a cliche, right, that in the words of Graham Allison, who studied the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 1960s, but very often your opinion on what went wrong with the Greek crisis and what happened in the Greek crisis also depends on where you see it, right? Depends on which perspective you are approaching it from. Is it, for example, good news that Greece didn't default or didn't default in a very chaotic way? In that sense, the outcome of the Greek crisis was kind of okay. But if you look at the outcome of the Greek crisis in terms of the social cost, in terms of the political cost, in terms of the reputational cost for the country, the outcome you will reach may be very different, right? And this is something that we also need to be keeping in mind. The normative point of departure from which we started the Greek crisis is very important. And again, the yardstick, the measure with which we come up with conclusions about what went well and what went wrong is also tremendously important here. Of course, the Greek crisis was not the only crisis in the Eurozone. The Greek crisis is enveloping a wider, more systemic crisis that affected other countries. This kind of comparative dimension about the crisis is an important consideration, and I will come back to this in a few minutes. Do we study Greece as part of a comparative phenomenon that also includes other peripheral member states of the Eurozone, or do we attribute a premium, perhaps, do we attribute greater significance to the exceptional nature of Greek politics? Very often people talk about this kind of Greek exceptionalism. It's not time here to discuss whether this is true or not, but clearly the fact that there were other countries with very different histories, with very different economies, very different political cultures to that of Greece that found themselves in a similar predicament is also something that ought to take some of our attention. I'm saying all of this because very often, and given the fact that many of us here are Greek, have very strong feelings about what happened in Greece, you see that a lot more, of course, in the popular discourse, but also in the academic debate as well, we tend to jump to conclusions too quickly. Right? So the problem of causalities in explaining the Greek crisis is one that I feel needs to be treated with a lot of caution. It's very easy to attribute one single causality to what went wrong. The truth is that there is not only one, there are many, many more. And how you go about proving this in the context of a PhD or an academic, a journal or a book and so on, is very, very important. And very often I read things in academic papers about Greece and the Eurozone crisis. I read a lot of stuff in newspapers in Greece and so on. And the thing that frustrates me the most about this is that very often people jump to conclusions without considering the broader picture. That's not to say you should not really try and find causalities in all of this. Of course you should. But we should also leave a little space on the back of our minds to wonder whether this kind of explanation is the only one that holds that holds true. And that brings me to my five things that we don't know about the Greek crisis. There were never six. There could have been four, but we'll keep them for five for now. And the most obvious one that comes to my mind is that if you look at the literature on the Greek crisis, it is clear to me that too often, perhaps too easily, Greece is treated as a single case, as an exceptional country where a lot of things went wrong, that has its own sets of explanations, its own sets of kind of theories that apply to it, that we cannot really tell the Greek story alongside other stories of other Eurozone member states, or indeed we cannot tell the Greek story of 2010, 2018 alongside other episodes of a Greek default or Greek economic crisis from our recent or not so recent past. It is interesting, for example, from the 25 books that deal with Greece and the crisis, only five have a comparative dimension. From the 122 journal articles that discuss Greece and the economic crisis, only eight study Greece alongside other Eurozone countries. That is a problem to me. I'm not a hardcore comparativist in all of that. I mean, many people have criticized the work I do with Kevin for being a little bit too Greek specific. But clearly, this kind of picture is bound to produce outcomes, scholarly conclusions that are biased towards the Greek specificities rather than trying to understand broader explanations that may also apply to other countries. I also feel that, although I would never recommend to any of you doing a PhD on this, and I'll come back to that in a minute, that of course the management of the Greek crisis is a study in repeated crisis management, both on the part of the Europeans and the IMF and so on, but also on the part of the Greek government. It is an excellent case study in which one can study leadership and crisis management methods. Not again trying to produce an anecdotal history of the Greek crisis, but trying to understand how in high-pressured moments in the country's history where the advisable way forward was contested and it was not clear, how under conditions of extreme uncertainty and lack of information and so on, people took decisions and how they took them and why, right? And I'm not talking here about some sort of a conspiratorial account of the Greek crisis, but instead a properly organized and theory-driven account of agency in all of that. Something that we don't have. We have a lot of accounts by protagonists, but not enough scholarly work about how these protagonists act during this critical moment. I also feel that there is a lot of literature. We know an awful lot about what happened during the crisis, who suffered, how the political system changed, how the media sort of informed this kind of debate. But we don't really know a lot about the run-up to the Greek crisis. And I put there the literature on the period between 2004 and 2009 is relatively limited. Not a lot has been written about the Karamanlis period, but then again, many people often argue that during that time, the derailment of macroeconomic indicators and so on took place, but why? Right? And was there something deeper that can explain why this happened during that time? Another thing that we don't know, of course, is how the story, or a theoretically informed story, of how Greece entered the Eurozone in 2001. We have a lot of literature about the Simitis years, absolutely, but we don't yet have a very good scholarly account of how Greece was able to convince other members of the European Union to be admitted in the club. And that's something I feel that lends itself to a lot more investigation. We've also heard and read in sort of journalistic circles about the dysfunctional dynamics within the Troika, but we don't yet know an awful lot about the how institutional cultures and competing preferences and so on affected the design and the implementation of the Greek program. I might have to revisit this because I was at an excellent talk this morning where one of you was actually talking about this, and it's brilliant, right? Because it seems to me that people have already started to pick up the right gaps, and that makes me feel very good indeed. And the final point is that, again, if you sort of bring to your mind some of the stories you hear in the Greek media about how the Americans saved the day in 2015, how Obama intervened with Merkel to avoid Greece crashing out of the Eurozone, the American dimension in all of this is not very clear, as indeed we know very little about how other non-European members of the IMF approach the Greek crisis and how they have affected the design and the implementation of the program. I know that there is a journalist who is based in the United States that is currently working on a project like this. Her name is Katerina Sokol. I don't think that she's publishing a book yet, but I know that she has done a lot of interviews and a lot of primary research on the American dimension, but I'm sure there is a lot more to say about this, and that's perhaps something particularly placed in a more theoretical context could be a useful thing to look at. Let me just try and come to a conclusion. I promise I wouldn't speak for too long, and hopefully I can keep in time. First thing, when researching the Greek crisis, beware of the dependent variable, right? Be absolutely clear about what is it that you are trying to study and what is the outcome that you are trying to explain. Very often people put too much stuff in this dependent variable. There's not enough clarity. It's too broad. People trying to explain, and there's a big temptation, we have all done it, trying to explain too much. And in the context of the PhD, that's never a good idea. Right? It's always, and I'm sure Kevin would have bored you this in the morning, it is always much, much better to concentrate on a small set of explanation, on a small dependent variable that can be done properly and you can control it well, rather than get involved in a very, very big set of explanatory variables and at the end produce something that is not perhaps as robust. I repeat again what I said earlier on, be careful with your causalities, right? Try, of course, always to find the causal mechanisms. I've heard some feedback to that effect this morning, and it was great. Be careful on how this is done, right? Be absolutely clear at the beginning of your work, what is it that you want to do? It might also be very useful to say to people what is that you are not trying to do, just to make absolutely clear that you ring-fence your dependent variable, and then you go about dealing with it in a systematic way. The second and third point go together. It has to do with scope and access to information. As I said earlier on, there is plenty of empirical material with which to study the Greek crisis. Indeed, there are very few things that we don't know about it. And perhaps the things that we don't know about it, neither you nor us can probably ever find out. I would have loved to hear what, Wolfgang Schäuble said to Venizelos in the meeting in that hotel in the basement and so on. The problem is, how likely are you to interview Schäuble or Venizelos. Venizelos, perhaps some of you would, right? But again, when you are trying to pose your research question, when you are trying to be specific about what is it that you are trying to explain, always think again, is it something that I can find the necessary information for? Or is it perhaps better that I make a claim that is not so flashy, but I go about doing it in a very systematic way? And I think that brings me to my next point, which is I would consider it a risky strategy for somebody to enter a PhD on the Greek crisis, trying to tell people that I'm going to give you a piece of empirical information that changes everything you know about the Greek crisis. Chances are somebody who says that makes a claim that is too overblown. You could write fantastic PhDs, you could write fantastic journal articles, you could write fantastic books with the empirical information that is out there. If there is one thing that the literature on the Greek crisis is still relatively thin on, is theory, right? That very often the Greek crisis is told in theoretically rather shallow manners, and also try and think of new methodological ways of approaching this topic. You know, I'm a political scientist, but I have to say the things that I have read that excited me the most about the Greek crisis were more connected with anthropology or with sociology, you know, with history sometimes. There is a lot of scope to innovate on things that are not necessarily empirical. And that is good news, I guess, because that will also get you to think more broadly about what is it that your PhD and your articles and so on contribute to the literature. I mean, we are all academic with a strong interest in Greece. A lot of us earn our living in a country where interest for Greece is not great, right? So at every time that we're trying to do our own research, we're trying to justify to a wider audience what is it that you can learn from the Greek case study, right? How is Greece relevant to other countries, to other audiences? And I think that is a critical point for you to consider in designing your career later on. You know, before I leave you, I thought I should show you this. These are the 10 best journals in political science, according to a ranking that I'm not going to go into details about. But apparently, that's the 10 best journals in political science, right? The numbers you see in these brackets are numbers of articles that have Greece, not Greece and crisis, but simply Greece on the title. So out of these 122 journal articles that I mentioned earlier on, only 8 of them have been published in the top 10 academic journals. If you go further down the list, if you look at journals between 10 and 20, then another 20 articles come into it. Well, that's actually not bad going. I thought, you know, that there are 28 articles with Greece on the title published in the top 20 academic journals over the past decade. That's good going, but the target should always be that. Not necessarily because we are slaves to impact factors and journal ratings and so on, because that, in a way, it's a mirror that let us reflect on how relevant is the story we're trying to say about Greece to a wider audience. You are not in any of them. You are. Yes.
You are, but he excluded.
But presumably the 122 refer to different disciplines. This is political science.
This is only political science, but it only includes Greece in the title, not crisis.
Yeah.
So there are articles here about issues relating to Greece that are not do not have crisis in the title. Right? But the point is not the numbers, and I know insecure academics were trying to figure out, you know, my stuff in there. But that's not the point. The point is, how do we say a Greek story that is relevant to a wider audience? And ultimately, this is the main sort of added value you can bring to the discipline, making Greece not exceptional, but making Greece or looking at Greece as part of a wider sort of set of theoretical and empirical and methodological debates with through which you will be able to discuss with other academics in various other disciplines. So thanks very much for listening.
Thank you, Dimitri, and given the tone of your last comment, let me say that it was almost interesting.
I don't want to spoil it.
George.
It is a dubious blessing, of course, to come after such an eloquent speaker, and to boot one who has said most of what I would be saying in his place anyway. But I'm going to free ride on some of the wisdom that he has offered, and I'm going to. I've kept some points there, which you might have noticed. So in any case, Dimitri mentioned the importance, the prominence, the salience of Greece in the global academic discourse and literature, which this reminds this phrase that Greece is the country which, having settled for not being a global power, decided to become a global nuisance. First of all, the five things that we did not know about the crisis, now we know, so I have these five things that we now know, and I've added a few more to them, drawing on some of the interesting points that Dimitri has made. Now, first of all, and something that I think it's important to keep in mind, is that if one poses the question, why did this crisis happen, and the crisis is mainly, first of all, it's a financial and economic crisis in the case of Greece. On top of that, you have a social crisis and a political crisis and various crises and democratic crisis, but it started as a financial crisis. And on that, there is no mystery. There's no cognitive enigma to be resolved. I mean, the Greek crisis was an extremely predictable case of an accident that was bound to happen. It was a case of an economy that ended up in a condition of extreme vulnerability as a result of its public sector deficits and the public debt. And in that case, it was a textbook crisis in the EMU. But what is misleading about that is that the EMU crisis, the Eurozone crisis, of which Greece was part, was not a textbook crisis. So in a way, Greece did a disservice to the Eurozone by being the first one to fail, and by allowing this story to be built that the Eurozone crisis is a crisis of fiscal recklessness. The Greek crisis was a crisis of fiscal recklessness, but the Greek crisis inside the Eurozone was part of a crisis of external imbalances, which was the result of asymmetries in the EMU and architectural defects in the EMU structure and wrong policies that ignored the buildup of these external imbalances, and in particular, the buildup of current account deficits in the peripheral countries, corresponding to a high level of indebtedness of their economies, both public sector and private sector, or mainly one of the two, vis-a-vis the rest of the Eurozone. So what, in fact, catapulted Greece and the other countries to the crisis was the current account deficit and the net foreign debt, rather than the budget deficit and the public debt. And this is an important thing to know. And of course, to that, one can add the long-standing weaknesses, the structural weaknesses of the Greek economy and the problems of competitiveness, but they themselves are not sufficient to explain why the economy crashed. And an economy crashes if it is heading towards the wall at a very high speed. And as it has been said, in such cases, it is not the speed that kills you, it's the sudden stop. And the crash was actually the result of a sudden stop. And in fact, this is the term used in the literature. The sudden stop meaning that these economies in the periphery were growing by borrowing from the rest of the world, and especially the rest of the Eurozone, and particularly the creditor countries, or the core economies, the exporting economies. They were borrowing, they were building up deficits, external deficits, which after a certain point became unsustainable. And they could not be serviced. And these current account deficits were financed by capital inflows which were the capital inflows that were accumulating in the exporting economies of the Eurozone poor. So to put it very simply or simplistically, the German economy was exporting equipment and cars and refrigerators to Greeks, who were buying them by putting the cost on the credit card, which had on the other side the Greek banking system, which was borrowing from the interbank market or from investor, institutional investors in Germany or other surplus countries. Again, this is a very simplistic depiction, but it's not far from the truth. And I'm saying that because this is part of the things that we know about the Eurozone crisis. And it's important to distinguish in any research endeavor the known knowns, to put it in the immortal words of ignominious mortal who had a very bad political legacy in his political resume, the known knowns, the things that we know about the Eurozone crisis and about the Greek crisis, the things that we know that we do not know, the known unknowns, and there are some of them empirically, and there are some of them especially when it comes to the legacies of the crisis, and I'll come back to that, and the unknown unknowns, which is what research will reveal, and especially what good journalism is constantly revealing. So that was my first point, which brings me to my second point, that again, on when it comes to the content of the adjustment policies, there is a common ground which has been reached, at least among economists or among economics approaches, about what things where the majority agrees. So the things where there is common ground and there is a consensus, among others, include that the EMU was unready for the crisis, that it was unready because it was incomplete, and it responded in an insufficient manner, that the debt restructuring should have taken place earlier, but there were clear constraints and objections to that, that Greece needed reforms, that the twin deficit could not be sustainable forever to such an extent, that it needed to be stabilized, to be reduced, and in reducing that, some degree of recession, at least some degree of recession, would have been inevitable. There is a common understanding about these things. Where there is no agreement, because a lot of what is being said about the Greek crisis is areas that are heavily controverted, is about the magnitude of fiscal and income austerity, and I'm talking in normative terms now, elements of the package that have been highly controverted, the wage cuts, the minimum wage cut, structural reforms, labor market liberalization, they have been contested. There have been strong arguments arguing about how advisable they were, and the degree of hysteresis effects. Now, by hysteresis, I mean, and I use it in the economics term, the Keynesian literature, the longer standing results, the effects of the crisis. And I think this is one of the areas that probably invite very important research to be done in the future. What are the long-standing results of the Greek crisis? And I'm not just talking about the economic effects in terms of lost productive capacity, in terms of low employment rate and the disinvestment. I'm talking about the longer-term effects of the equivalent of a Great Depression, of a crisis which had the depth of the US Great Depression of the 30s, which is a historically unique event for the 20th century, but it had double its length. Now this is, the uniqueness of this event is a central focal point, or should be a central focal point of social science research. Because what it creates and what it does to any society or to any economy or to any polity, or I'm talking about both the national and even the European polity, calls for research. In terms of the kind of attitudinal changes it leaves behind, in terms of the generational replacement that it creates, in terms of the flow of human capital that it triggers, and the degree to which this is or is not reversible and retrievable. So I think that an important focus in future research should be, among others, on the attitudinal changes and value systems that have been generated as a result of this crisis. We talk about the German economy, and we often attribute the post-war policies and institutions in Germany not only to the defeat in the war and the institutional apparatus and regime that was installed by the Western powers, but to the folk memory of hyperinflation from the Weimar Republic times. Interestingly enough, there is the folk memory of the hyperinflation, but less so the folk memory of the high unemployment of the 30s. The first was in the 20s, the third was in the 30s. Probably the second was more critical in bringing about Nazism. But in Germany, the hyperinflation, for some reason, had a lasting effect that lasted decades after the crisis and after the war, and formed the institutions and the policies and, in fact, the whole political system that was structured and built in post-war Germany. So, more ambitiously, one would be and should be looking at these longer-term changes. And of course, as it often happens in these, it's too early to tell. But the Greek crisis was also unique in the sense that it was the greatest, the steepest crisis, the deepest crisis in contemporary Greece, but also a kind of a unique crisis for the Eurozone. It was also unique in the sense that it was the only crisis that was dealt with without the instrument of devaluation, and it carries the policy challenges that have been already mentioned. And something very important about the crisis is that what we saw is not actually the worst outcome of what was expected to be seen if one went back to 2010-2011. I remember how many times, and I've spent many, many hours talking to foreign journalists, analysts, people who were coming to learn about Greece, and the question they would pose time after time would be, when will you default, when will you exit the euro, when will there be a social explosion, and what does this mean for democracy, and the rise of the extreme right, and even the threat of a dictatorship. Everything was on the horizon of probable scenario. And looking back, most of this did not happen. And I think it is an element of remarkable resilience of Greek democracy that we now have basically centripetal, after having gone through the vagaries of extreme demagoguery and populism, a very centripetal and pro-European, remarkably pro-European political system, by a large majority, especially if one compares it to other countries in Europe, and especially if one compares it to other countries in Europe whose economies have been doing much, much better. I'm talking about economies where unemployment is not at 20%, but it's at 3% or 4%. So that is something to keep in mind. In our tendency to self-flagellate, I think we should take a moment to appreciate the resilience that our democratic polity and society has shown in terms of not leading itself to the path of even worse outcomes than the ones that we have seen. As Dimitri has said, this is a case, this is an area, this is a field which is that is normatively charged. The Greek crisis has fascinated us intellectually because it is so potent emotionally, because we are all a part of its consequences, of its context, because our lives have been shaped to a very significant extent by this crisis. And this poses a challenge from an academic point of view, a challenge of separating beliefs from analysis, of separating our parti pris from the enterprise of trying to provide a methodologically and epistemologically robust research. And there is a tendency to over-rely on our preconceptions, which calls for more self-reflection regarding our own views and conclusions. The fourth point is that the Greek crisis offers a case for comparativism and multi or cross-disciplinarity, as Dimitri has very eloquently pointed out. Greece may be an extreme case in the continuum of crisis economies, but it is not exceptional in the sense that it calls for a exceptional instruments of analysis to examine it. We should examine it through comparative lenses, even if at some moments, in some instances, it is an outlier. And one cannot really understand, and this is the case for cross-disciplinarity, one cannot really understand why Greece failed just by following an economic path of analysis without taking into account the cultural context and the social politics. But one cannot explain failure without obviously appreciating the economics, both the macro and the micro, both the Greek and the European economics. And I would say that there's a lurking comparison also with the counterfactual, which I think enters any attempt to view the Greek crisis, which automatically triggers the question, what if Greece had not been bailed out? What if Greece had defaulted? What if Greece had not entered the euro? And clearly, this is the kind of comparative analysis, comparison with the counterfactual, that cannot be serviced, perhaps through a kind of a scenariology which is outside the scope of a PhD analysis, but still, it is part of the broader intellectual enterprise to at least confront this kind of counterfactual. The fifth is that, as Dimitri said, there is an enormous wealth of empirical evidence out there, which is both overwhelming in the positive sense, but also frustrating. Because everything that can possibly be written about the Eurozone, about the Greek crisis, has probably already been written. Any documents on the economics and the data are probably already out there. And this is very challenging because it attaches a premium on how one will organize, analyze, abstract from this wealth of material. And this is a deeply rigorous exercise of intellectual discipline, which is more challenging than the challenge of discovering information that has not been yet brought to the public realm. And this puts an additional premium, given the fact that the evidence is so much out there, on empirical precision, on understanding the specifics, on avoiding generalizations that could be obfuscating the kind of the specificity of the field, especially since one can go deeper and more accurately on a number of areas and a number of observations. Now, I don't know why my title has collapsed, but the risk of overdeterminism, again, Dimitri mentioned this, there is a tendency to believe, especially if one comes into this enterprise with a parti pris, there's a tendency to believe that the outcomes are predetermined. And there's a tendency to believe that what happened was actually intended. And there's a tendency to discount for the strong possibility that what happened was the result of accidents or unanticipated and unintended consequences of actions. Or what happened was not intended and desired and was certainly not the first preference of any of the actors involved. But it was a point of compromise, of a very unhappy compromise, a very unwelcome compromise that came out as a result of common denominator solutions in a polity such as the Eurozone polity and system, which has a reputation of muddling through the difficult issues and resolving crises through resorting to intergovernmentalism. And especially in this case, a very asymmetric version of intergovernmentalism where the power of national governments are not equal. Or that certain national governments do not have the same power as others, to put it simply. And this is even more so since we are dealing with cases and choices that are very, I would say, that are an exception to the European standard of integration. The European standard of integration is to devise package deals that are in some way are win-wins. So the way of packaging the single market with the structural funds and cohesion policies creates a win-win. The more competitive countries of the north, or whatever if you like, have an interest in pursuing the internal market. The southerners do not like it so much, but the southerners get greater budget policies and inflows which support their development capacity and support their infrastructure, and thus we have a win-win. We have a package through which everyone, every side gains, even if each one gains different things and to a different extent. In this case, we have a crisis which can only generate losers and can only distribute losses. And the whole political negotiation is about how you distribute the losses and who will take which part of the pain. And in our case, the crisis countries took the pain of adjustment, and the northern countries took the credit risk. And if one says that Germany, for example, has benefited from the crisis, if one looks at the interest rate and the yield through which Germany has been borrowing through the crisis, one could reach this conclusion. I think this is a wrong conclusion in the sense that Germany would not have chosen this outcome, even if it has close to zero borrowing costs, because it is sitting on a mountain of assets that are potentially non-serviceable. These are the liabilities of the southern economies, which could become losses for the German sovereign and for the other creditor countries if they're incapable of servicing their debt. And I'm not even mentioning QE and the impact that it has on the German economy. It is clear that the choices that were followed were the result of ugly and painful compromises. Obviously, it is clear that the countries that carried the heaviest cost, the most painful cost of adjustment, were the crisis economies. So it is important to keep in mind that the final paths, the paths that evolve, are not necessarily reflecting the preferences of the actors, but have resulted from the interaction of different interests, different strategies, and different degrees of negotiating power. And of course, the perennial question in social science between structure and agency, were they pushed or did they jump? How do you draw the balance between the importance of structural factors, the more enduring forces, both at the national and the European level, or the global level, and leadership and agency? And I think this requires, first of all, very solid empirical research to try and find out what were the rooms for maneuver of actors, what were their actual spaces for discretion, whether there was what degree of discretion they had in their choices, in order to determine what the impact of these external determining factors was. There is a risk of over-reductionism, which is fed by our parti pris in this exercise. There's a risk to attribute the crisis to one kind of factor, be that the Greek political system only, or the EMU, or whatever, and one sees it is easy to subscribe to such a tendency, but it should always be weighed against the alternative explanation, and it seems to me that the explanations that are multi-causal tend to be more rich and more close to reality. But I'm saying that, of course, keeping in mind that academia is a constant exercise at intellectual self-discipline, that academia imposes parsimony in the selection of variables and explanations. And whenever one is confronted with the breadth and the depth and the richness of material versus the need to write an elegant PhD thesis, one should exercise this self-discipline, which results from the imperative of scientific and methodological parsimony, and be patient until one has concluded the PhD, when one can easily indulge into the pleasures of tackling with the richness of real life. So until then, καλό κουράγιο, ας όλοι.
Thank you, George, very much. Thank you to Demetrios and George equally. I guess I was struck by the focus here, which is really about a research agenda. And it fits very nicely the purposes of a symposium for current researchers. Thinking about this as a research agenda rather than the specifics of the policy case, then I like very much the comment that George has just made about overdeterminism, that we could explain the crisis on the basis of this multiplicity of factors which made the crisis entirely predictable. A crisis, of course, which wasn't actually predicted by many people at all at the time. So I would hesitate to quote the Queen of England in any kind of intellectual capacity here, but some years ago when this building was opened, she came and joined an economics lecture. She had one question. Why didn't anyone predict the crisis? And I was recalling that comment on the basis now of saying that the risk for researchers is that we make our explanation overdetermined, that of course it was entirely predictable that the crisis would occur, simply that no one did at the time forecast it. If we think in terms of this as a research agenda, then, what I picked up from both of you were comments here in terms of time. We might think of a counterfactual element to the explanation of the crisis, but perhaps that counterfactual scenario building is something which is easier with the passage of more time, more distance. And indeed, in terms of distance, you also made the comment about the normative entanglements that's in the middle of the crisis or being based within in situ, as it were, the difficulty of gaining objectivity when so much is happening around you. But let me perhaps, because I'm going to open it up to the audience very soon, perhaps if I could just ask both of you to respond to one kind of practical research aspect here. You both said, I think, that there is great value in placing the Greek case in comparison in order to understand the proper causes of things, the distinctive elements, to avoid Greek exceptionalism. Comparison is important. I wonder if you could think of any advice or any tips that PhD students face practical constraints. If they're doing a PhD in Greece, studying Greece is relatively easy, it's on the doorstep. But there are practical limitations to how you could compare Greece and another country. Wonderful access, or relatively greater access domestically, but you can't necessarily travel to Germany or Portugal or whatever. So I wonder if both of you might comment in terms of how to overcome that constraint, because there are, of course, comparisons at different levels, to different extents, and how a researcher beginning a PhD on the Greek crisis might go about placing Greece in some kind of comparative context. Dimitri, do you want to?
I guess, yeah, I mean, it's the obvious comparative here, which comes with the very limited sort of transaction cost, would be Cyprus. It's interesting that, not to my knowledge at least, there hasn't yet been a very good article that compares Greece with Cyprus. There are different cases in many ways, of course, but that is something that would not require you know, very difficult access to policymakers that perhaps may not be available. The other point to make is that, again, we always advise our students to conduct a lot of interviews with policymakers and, you know, sort of use that as a way to establish originality in their own empirical sort of investigation. But you don't need necessarily to access policymakers in different parts of Europe. You might be able to look at data sets that exist, that they are open to the public, from electoral surveys to expert surveys. There is a lot of evidence out there that you can access without huge cost. I'll come back to the point I made earlier on that, and from what I gather from George, we're in agreement here that the empirical added value you can bring into this field is limited and unlikely to lead you to an explanation that you couldn't explore without that extra material. So I would again encourage people to think more carefully about the methodology, think more carefully about the theory, because I think that would be the way to maximize the input, the impact of your research, and tell a story that is in many ways not bound by the Greek exception, by Greek exceptionalism, right? And would reach a wider audience.
I think Portugal is an inviting case for a comparison. It's a country of a similar economic size, even similar population, part of the Mediterranean enlargement. It's a country that failed through both its public and private sector indebtedness, Greece mainly public sector, and followed a different path of political reaction to the crisis, even though the political system in Portugal should not fundamentally differ from that of Greece. The way in which it responded was different. The cross-party political consensus was vital in ensuring a modicum of social political stability and consensus that allowed Portugal to graduate much faster from the crisis. And of course, the economic adjustment was also more successful in Portugal, in the sense that Portugal managed to exit the crisis through its exports. It managed to transform the economy into a much more export-oriented economy, to raise the size of its export sector, managed to integrate better in global supply chains, using the links with the Spanish and the German economy, but these were underlying economic strategies and business strategies that had preceded the crisis and were very useful as adjustment strategies to the crisis. And at the end of the day, Portugal is doing much better than Greece in many respects, and has even been able to offer an alternative of reversing some of the policies in a way that is accepted by the Eurozone, and in fact has been proven successful even in the markets. So I think that on a step-by-step, in an approach that is obviously theoretically and conceptually nested, that's in a robust way, but also empirically sensible and sensitive and refined, I think one can draw a very interesting conclusion from such a comparison.
Yes, I mean, let me reinforce your last point about the location of the Greek case, the location of the Greek case in a conceptual framework. You could actually make the comparisons in some meaningful respects without traveling anywhere by the use of a conceptual frame, a theory, which helps to answer the question, what is Greece a case of? You can situate Greece in that wider frame. You're making choices and you're implying a frame of comparison which others can pick up. Okay, so let's now open it up to you, your questions and comments. If you could just say who you are and then make your contribution. Who would like to begin, please? And if you do, thank you. Can you just wait for the microphone because it's being recorded?
From you. Thank you very much. It's a fascinating discussion. I remember when I was a graduate student back in the 1990s, I used to impress my political science colleagues by describing the Greek political system, how eccentric it is. I think if you want to take the comparative, perspective, Greece is an unusual political system.
An unusual
political system, starting from the bonus, which is not common, distortion of proportional representation, the sizes of the different electoral districts, the fact that
the exceptional aspect is the trigger of parliamentary elections.
The trigger of parliamentary elections. So different, many different elements on the Greek political system that make it unusual. So you mentioned before the question of monoposal explanations and the question of counterfactuals. If Greece had a different political system, if it was a presidential system such as Cyprus, or if it was Portugal, as you mentioned, where there is a more conventional PR system, would Greece have dealt with the whole crisis differently if it had a more conventional way of dealing with decision making? The political system was not as eccentric. The word eccentric was used in an article in the 1990s by Diamandouros and Leiphardt when they were comparing the different political systems Southern Europe has. So I was wondering about the counterfactual part, but also the monocausal explanation here is very interesting because of the possibility of having repetitive elections in Greece in the future, either with PR, if it works in the following elections, or with the possibility of having majoritarian elections but having PR in the elections after, and then going back to majoritarian system if the government is in a position, the next government is in a position to do. So we have probably have a decade, I guess, to study this question, both in terms of the counterfactual of what have happened before, but based on the possibility of Greece changing its electoral system over and over, following the transition when Syriza supported the electoral system. So I was wondering about what you think about that, and what is your prediction? Would PR bring chaos to Greece, as some argue, or would it bring more consensus, as you hinted, on the question of the comparison with Portugal?
Okay. Thank you for that. Let's, in the interest of time, gather some more comments. Constantino here.
Thank you very much for your remarkable remarks. I have a question in regards to crisis, two-faceted question. Chinese, the word crisis signifies two symbols, danger and opportunity.
Mm.
And we have this infamous statement by Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, never waste a good crisis.
Yes.
To what extent have we taken advantage of the crisis and have turned it into an opportunity? Has this been the crisis that has been wasted? And then secondly, as academics, you know, we're spilling ink, I'm filling the ink, spending hours and hours conducting research and attempting to fill in the gap. What is the responsibility that lies on our shoulders for the Greek crisis? To what extent have we been a part of the problem rather than the solution? And how do we overcome that, especially after a decade?
Wow. Okay, I'll let you ponder that that question. There were other hands up as well. Please.
Thank you very much for your insightful remarks. I would like you to set forth an idea for a conceptual framework, since you mentioned it. I'm a public policy scholar, so I can see it from this perspective. It's about a part of the cycle which is called policy learning.
Yes.
And I think Professor Papoulatos had published an excellent article 2 years ago on Financial Times about the lessons drawn from the Greek crisis. And my question would be whether, if we use these lessons and ask the policymakers to reflect on these lessons, do you think that they have distilled similar lessons, or do you think they have different reflections on this crisis? And of course, this could be conducted in a comparative fashion with other countries like Portugal, Spain, or Cyprus.
Thank you. Manuel?
Thank you. My name is Galinianos. I'm a professor of economics at the University of London. I have a much more narrow question for the majors mostly. In one of your comments, you said that it would be worthwhile to study the run-up to the crisis, which I very much agree with. My question is about the timing. So the years you said is 2004 to 2009. An alternative time horizon would be around 2000 to 2009, so around the time that Greece entered the Eurozone. That might be, and that would be my question to you, a more natural breaking point. In my mind, at least, both some of the economic statistics started switching at that time, so the current account and external imbalances started being magnified at that time, but also the political side, you had the onset of reform fatigue. In the 90s, you had a lot of reform. After about 2000, that kind of stopped. So I was wondering if you would agree with this assessment, or you think that 2004 is a more natural ready point.
Thank you.
An idea I have when I try to compare the Greek crisis with other crisis countries is that I think it serves us a lot if we actually divide temporarily the Greek crisis to different phases, right? Because, as you said, it's such a long crisis, the English crisis, and obviously it developed a lot. What I think is even more important is that if we actually kind of divide the Greek crisis to smaller parts, it actually makes it easier to compare the actual political development. So, for example, let's say Portugal. You said Portugal could be a good comparison. I mean, if we look at the outcome of the crisis, it's not a good comparison in the sense that Greece had a huge, a much bigger actually effort to make. So, in that sense, you can say Portugal is a, you know, you have some variation of dependent variable, successful case. But again, the effort was smaller, right? On the other hand, if you want to actually look at the national ownership of the program, then that's a very fruitful comparison, right? I mean, as you said, Portugal is the same, why the Portuguese system took a different role. But again, that actually needs to make, you know, a temporal break point at the beginning of the crisis for the first 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my idea. I mean, you know, we see the Greek crisis as one unitary thing. I think it actually serves us a lot if we break it into smaller pieces.
Great. Sorry, can we take the gentleman at the back and then we'll
send
to you.
So thank you, all three of you. I have a question addressed to Professor Pagoulatos. So Greek academics have actively participated in the management of the Greek crisis throughout the last few years, right? So how easy is it for PhD students to avoid the influence of their own supervisors when they are doing research about Greece, okay, when they have their supervisors influencing them in terms of their underlying assumptions, and how do you deal with that?
In terms of their?
Underlying assumptions,
right.
And how do you deal with it? Thank you.
Thanks, and then...
Thank you. Hi. I'm wondering, how do you explain the fact that after 10 years of crisis, the investments in Greece, the real net investments, are still negative? Regarding the fact that many, it was a very common explanation that the wages in Greece until 2008 were high, relatively high, but now we have a 20%, 25% decrease of the unit labor costs or wages, and the real net investments are still negative. Okay, and especially apart from the privatizations. So how do you explain that? And maybe an indication would be that the high public debt, the high primary surpluses, and maybe that's why Portugal, where the public debt was only 130% in 2014, that was the highest point. Maybe that's why Portugal performs better. I don't know. Thank you.
And then here, please, Katrina.
From the University of probably partly answering the last question as well. Is there a timing issue of reforms? Do you think I am drawing this from one of the slides, which was talking about structural reforms, and it relates to the previous question of union labor. The labor cost, unit labor cost. Have we done the reforms, at least those that were done? I'm not going to comment on this in the time. Or in the order, the sequencing of reforms the way it needed to be in your aspect. So did we focus a lot on the labor versus the product market? Is there more importance to be placed in the product market compared to what has been done, more competition, more technological content of, let's say, innovation, etc., all these reforms in the product market compared to the labor market? Whether the timing actually was imposed, I had the feeling that at the beginning of the crisis, there's a lot of things to be done just after being requested to tick the box, and therefore those that were more easy or less reluctant to change, let's say, were done first. Maybe we did them only because of pressure. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry, just in the interest of time, I think these are great questions. They have the advantage of not being simple questions. I think we have opportunity to give both of our speakers literally about 4 minutes each. Shall we go in reverse order?
Each question.
So don't necessarily feel that you have to answer the same questions, but select.
Okay. I don't agree very much that the Greek electoral system, political system, is eccentric. I would locate it in the middle between purely majoritarian and simple proportional systems, being a reinforced proportional system. So I would say that a purely majoritarian first past the post system, in my mind, is eccentric. A reinforced proportional is not. It's been a system that has provided stable governments, single party governments, which in that sense makes it normal. If you looked at it, prima facie would say that it would not necessarily nurture public sector indebtedness or deficit. You would expect that to happen in case where you have more veto players. In Belgium, for example, you know, you have a joint decision trap situations and so forth. So I would not say that prima facie the political system in terms of electoral system offers the explanation to that or to the path after the crisis. Crisis being wasted or crisis as an opportunity. Look, I'm not part of those who say, and there are many in Greece who say that nothing has happened and we have corrected nothing and there's been no reform. Very important reforms have taken place and important imbalances have been eradicated. The single most important poisonous legacy of the crisis is the legacy of austerity, disinvestment, and especially long-term unemployment, which has led to a destruction of human capital and to the loss of an important part of that as brain drain abroad. This has been a result of the mix of austerity, but especially of the duration of the crisis. Now, not wanting to make a political point on that, it might be interpreted as such, but if the crisis had ended in 2013, 2013 was the last year of recession, 2014 was a year of positive growth, 2014 was a year of growth for the entire Eurozone, 2015 was a year of strong growth for the entire Eurozone, including crisis countries, year of QE, etc. 2016, the same, the only country in exception to that rule was Greece, 2015-16. The whole narrative of the crisis and the legacies of the crisis would have been different if the last year of the crisis was 2013. Again, this is not a political point, but it is a point you have to take into account because it makes a difference whether you've lost 25% of your GDP and you have recovered it or part of it 10 years down the road, and where 10 years down the road you're just exiting a 9-year recession. It makes a huge difference if an economy is at the state of fragility and vulnerability that the Greek economy and the Greek socio-economy was. Policy makers have learned lessons. I think that, again, if I want to be optimistic, yes, they have to a significant extent. There's a consensus against large deficits. There's a cross-party consensus in support of primary budget surpluses, obviously not the 3.5 surpluses that are there, but of the need to generate some degree of primary budget surpluses. This is a part of a cross-party consensus. This was not the case before the crisis. I remind you that we were running a primary budget deficit between 2002 and 2013 every year, okay, without anyone complaining. There's an understanding that the pension system as it was not sustainable, even if there's no appreciation, obviously, of the pension cuts and the increase of social security contributions. So there is an understanding that the situation pre-crisis was not sustainable. There is a certain degree of self-restraint exercised by the political system today as compared to 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013. There is a strong support for the euro, where numbers show that the acceptance of the euro is higher today than it was before. If the question is whether you would prefer to exit the euro or not. And this comes together with appreciating the fact that remaining in the euro comes with a cost, and the cost of economic adjustment and the cost of having to be competitive. And there is a turn of tide with regard to tolerance to clientelism, which was not there pre-crisis. There was much greater tolerance to clientelism and corruption and petty corruption and tax evasion compared to where we are today. We haven't reached the promised land, but I think that there are, these are positive lessons.
George, there's a question specifically about the responsibility of academics.
I was coming to that. It's difficult to, I mean, obviously the academics who have had a role in the crisis have the advantage of having seen things as they have evolved, and this has influenced the way in which we try to interpret and to construct our understanding of the crisis. Obviously, we share a responsibility, those of us who have been part of the management of the crisis, even if some of us have not had an executive role in the direct sense. Clearly, that is a form of responsibility, and clearly we are biased, but I do not believe that we are more biased than other people who have not participated in the management of the crisis. Everyone carries their political biases, and I think that this is not a liability from the moment we can separate our personal views from our analysis, and from the moment we can exercise in self-reflection and differentiate what we have, our own experience from the broader experience, and integrate our own experience to the broader experience in a way that is as impartial as possible. I'm not saying this is easy. How easy can PhD students, how is it for PhD students to avoid the toxic, I add, influence of supervisors who have been involved in the crisis? This is a very good question. Depending on the supervisors. If the supervisors appreciate dissent, and I consider myself one of them, I find it very challenging to have a student who challenges my own views. My first PhD student was a member of the Communist Party in Greece, Communist Youth, and we had constant, endless disagreements. He did not complete his PhD, but that was not because of me. but I think that every academic who feels safe about their views appreciates a challenging student.
We were with you, George, until that conclusion. Dimitri.
Don't stay in Greece for a PhD, come to us here. We didn't have an executive role to play, although we do, of course, have an indirect share of the responsibility for what happened, of course. I'll go to Neophytos' point, and I think I'm in agreement with George there. I don't think that the Greek party system since Metapolitευση was that exceptional. In fact, it was the closest we've ever been to the European mainstream, in the sense that we had a bipolar system that kind of looked similar, although with some pathological things in it. But to me, the most exceptional part of our political system is how this bipolar between pro and anti-bailout political forces developed in 2010, 2011, 2012. I think now we are exiting this. Whether we will be able to return to a bipolar political system, I don't know. I personally would very much like that to happen. I think that it is, given Greece's political culture and the experiences we have from history and so on, I'd much rather have Greece having a strong bipolar a system than having any other. But that's a personal view, I guess. Was the crisis a wasted opportunity? I don't think so. I agree with George. There are a number of achievements. I think the biggest achievement that I think has actually sunk in sufficiently is the fact that we are all a bit more careful by measuring things now, right? That the political system, the electorate, perhaps we see, is now coming to a better understanding that the exercise of politics is an exercise in redistributing limited resources, right? And that's why it's hard, and that's why politicians deserve respect and so on. Because if you are redistributing an ever-growing pie, it's easy, right? But now I think most people have realized that this is not sustainable, and of course, the way we came to learn that lesson was not optimal, but I think the legacy of the crisis will probably stay in the system for the years to come.
have policymakers learned the lesson? I'm not going to, or what lessons have they learned? I'm not going to focus so much on the domestic side, because George covered that. But of course, there is an external dimension to this, which is what lessons, if any, non-Greek policymakers have learned about the Greek crisis. And I think, to my mind at least, the lesson that hopefully some people would learn was that the response to the Greek crisis was highly moralistic. And because of it, it was misguided. And some of the problems that some of you identified, the disinvestment, the lack of domestic growth and so on, are partly related to the design of the program. So I think that the toxic discourse around the Greek bailout early on in the process have had very lasting legacies, and hopefully as we come out of it now, probably European policymakers would also reflect that perhaps such high degree of emotional input into a crisis of that type was not best informed. The time frame of the or the period we need to focus more on, is it 2000, 2004? You are probably right. It is 2000. I wasn't trying to make a party political point here. The reason why I say 2004 is that I've recently, unfortunately, co-written it with Kevin. We've written a book chapter on the literature on Greece in the last 20 years, and we did find that the Simitis years have attracted a lot more scholarly attention than the Karamanlisi. I don't know why, but that's the truth, and I think that we need to know a little bit more about that period. But you are absolutely right. The problems that eventually led to the crisis did not start in 2004, right? They go back well before even 2000. But this kind of gap in our knowledge, I think it's an interesting one. I'll finally make a point about the comparison with Portugal, and also the comparison with a counterfactual. Don't listen to George. Never try to do a PhD.
No, yeah, I said that.
A counterfactual. That's right. Because that way you might lead yourself down a path and think you didn't mention this to a puzzle solving that cannot be solved. Right? Better stick to explaining what has happened rather than what would have happened, because no one knows that, right? So I think that's one thing. The comparison with Portugal is an interesting one. I think it is an excellent comparison, perhaps even better than Cyprus. But there are different in departure points, and the what has been asked of Greece was a lot more than that of Portugal. That brings me back to this idea of making sure that you're independent and your dependent variables are well thought out, that you are comparing apples with apples and not apples with another fruit, right? And because if you start making comparisons between things that are not qualitatively so similar, then you are bound to lead down paths that are not very very helpful. You don't need to have a comparison between Portugal and Greece in its entirety. Just pick up something smaller, right? It can be a political party, it can be a sector, it can be anything, right? So that way you might be able to insulate yourself from the danger of two dissimilar independent variables.
Okay, thanks. In 10 minutes time, you're due at the next session of panel discussions, I think this plenary presentation has been great from both of you, very much in keeping with the idea of a PhD symposium, a research agenda, research design, how to do the research, whilst also picking up on some of the key variables and conditions. So can you please join me in thanking both the Mitchell Sujet.